Podcast, a show about Indiana politics, history, and culture from the unapologetic perspective of the Hoosier left. My name is Scott Aaron Rogers, and I'm recording from Bloomington. Now, if you've read any of my campaign finance research over at scottaaronrogers.substack.com, you know I love to pick on Nepo babies, the children of successful people who inherit prominent positions based on name value and familial connections. Now, sure, there are some legitimately talented people in that group, those who could have earned their places on merit alone. But not everyone is a national treasure like actor Nicolas Cage, the nephew of famed director Francis Ford Coppola. Far more often, you get entitled blowhards who were, say, born on an emerald mine, bought good ideas from far more capable people, and then took credit as some sort of tech genius. Just for example. My guest today eschewed the easy path and set out on her own. Edgar Whitcomb was Indiana's 43rd governor from 1969 to 1973. A Republican, he had previously served as Secretary of State and was the last Indiana governor term-limited to a single four-year stint in office. His daughter, Trish, could have been Republican royalty, but found a party plagued by Nixonian corruption and increasingly turning hard right. So, she joined the Democratic Party to fight for transparency in government, including work on Senator Birchbeyer's unsuccessful 1980 re-election campaign. And can we just take a second to appreciate what an historic downgrade Indiana made in that election? We traded one of the best United States senators of the mid-20th century for Dan fucking Quayle. Maybe the worst trade in Indiana history, though the Colts trade up to take Jeff George number one in the 1990 NFL draft is right up there. Anyway. From her campaign website, quote, Trish's career path includes experiences in public education, where she worked as a classroom teacher. She left education to work in international public relations, banking, and public finance. Trish's career path never veered far from political activism. As a political consultant, she worked with anti-communist party members in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, then later co-authored a book, Revolution Road Trip, about the experience. End quote. Trish has managed several successful political campaigns, including that of Glenda Ritz for State Superintendent of Public Instruction in 2012. She has served as Executive Director of the Indiana Retired Teachers Association and is the former President of the Indiana Federation of Democratic Women. In 2021, she withdrew from the race to become State Democratic Party Chair when her son John tragically passed away at the age of 26. These days, she is running to replace Jim Lucas in House District 69, a largely rural district that includes the cities of Seymour, Brownstown, and Salem. In our conversation today, we'll discuss that loss and how it drives her to fight for a better Indiana. We'll talk about how market forces have abandoned rural Hoosiers and how too often the resulting emptiness has been filled by substance abuse. We'll get into the ways government could fill those gaps instead, and how what Trish calls limestone fever in the State House has kept Republican officials from doing anything meaningful in response. But first, I need your help. I'm going to ask for money, but hear me out. In a media environment filled with bland, lazy, both sides journalism at its best and blatant right-wing propaganda at its worst, Indiana needs independent left-wing media to inform Hoosiers about what's really going on in our state. My work is dedicated to calling out the Republican supermajority, their financial backers, and others in their network that actively work to make Hoosier lives worse. Those whose policies endanger our children through lax gun regulation, bullying queer youth, and poisoning our environment. I work to highlight these bad actors so we can replace them with more empathetic leadership, and also shine spotlight on Hoosier activists, organizations, and elected officials who are doing the hard work to build a more just, equitable, and compassionate Indiana for the next generation of Hoosiers. But I'll take on Democrats, too. When they put their donors over their voters, when they talk out both sides of their mouth, when they fail to push back against GOP authoritarian extremism with the necessary urgency and tenacity. I go deep to provide information and analysis you won't get anywhere else in Indiana. But I can't do it without you. I'm not motivated by the dollars, but everything costs money. Web hosting, equipment, editing software, travel to meet with other activists and organizers. I need your financial support with a paid subscription over at scottaaronrogers.substack.com. For $5 a month or $50 a year, you can help me push our state in a better direction and help me keep the lights on. And look, if you can't afford it at this time, you can still help. Subscribe at the free level over on Substack. Set your favorite podcast player to auto-download new episodes of the show. Rate and review the show on whatever platform you use. Follow me on social media at facebook.com/whosleft. That's H-O-O-S, left. I am also now on Blue Sky at the same handle. I'm personally at scottrog78, that is S-C-O-T-T-R-O-G-7-8, on Instagram, Threads, and Twitter. And on Mastodon at scottrog78@hoosier.social. I'm now posting video as well. Full episodes on YouTube and clips on TikTok. The handle on both of those is also at Who's Left. Please, subscribe. But most importantly, share our message. Forward the articles to friends, family, and colleagues. Don't just like, but share on social media. Print leaflets and drop them from a plane. With your investment, a full-time Who's Left looks like new content every day. Full coverage of the 2024 election cycle in Indiana and beyond, and it looks like zooming out to see how the networks acting in our state function nationally and even globally. It might not be in my financial interest, but I do not plan on paywalling any content because I believe in open access to information, and your support helps me make that content freely available to all Hoosiers. But I desperately need your contributions in order to keep bringing you this meaningful content. So please, before this interview, pause right now, go to scottaaronrogers.substack.com and subscribe at the paid level. To those who have contributed already, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. I appreciate every penny, and it means the world to me and to everybody. Thanks for listening. Now here's my interview with Trish Whitcomb. Trish Whitcomb, thank you for joining the Who's Left podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So, first things first, introduce yourself to our listeners.
My name's Trish Whitcomb, and I am from Seymour, Indiana. I grew up here. I went to Butler. I went to graduate school at the University of Wyoming, where I had a teaching assistantship and taught U.S. Constitution on Wyoming state government. I've been a classroom teacher. I've worked at the Department of Education. I've been involved in public relations, banking, and politics. It's very checkered, my past, very checkered. And I am married, and my husband's an attorney. His name's Russ Sipes. And that's it in a nutshell. And I'm from Jackson County, where the Brownstown Braves just won the state tournament for their division. So, and then Scottsburg right down the road. So this is basketball heaven.
Yes, yes. We Hoosiers love our basketball.
We even love Purdue enough, right now.
Enough that even as an IU grad, I am pulling for Purdue. Yes.
Right.
So let's rewind a little bit, talk about your background. So, now, in this space, if there is one thing I rail about, it is nepotism, right? The big donors that influence Indiana politics. It's always like with inherited wealth, right? It's never the people that built the businesses. It's always their kids. So you know, normally this is not a friendly space for the children of prominent people. Your father, Ed Whitcomb, was a prominent Republican politician, served as a state senator, secretary of state, and then a governor for one term. You probably could have followed in his footsteps, used those connections and relationships, but you broke with the Republican Party at a very young age. Will you talk a little bit about that process and about forging your own path politically?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Part of it started... in the summer, when I went to Butler for teacher prep, you know, I was an elementary and special ed teacher for a while. I worked at Central State Hospital. And I don't know if you recall, that's a residential treatment place. And it had its own school. And so I was a teacher's assistant for 3 years at Central State. And during that time, Cordelia Lewis was an administrator with the nurses. And she and I became good friends. And that was the beginning of my conversion, if you would. It kind of began during Watergate. I mean, that was a pretty ugly time for America. And then I went to graduate school in Wyoming, where nobody knew me. Nobody knew anything about my background as being from a Republican family. And that's where I joined Western States for Kennedy as a young person. And one thing I will tell you, Scott, it was kind of funny. The first time I went to a Democratic meeting in Wyoming, they said the pledge and a prayer. And I'm like, they're just like Republicans. Oh my God. You know, they're not wearing horns and they're not wearing, you know, wagging tails or anything like that. So, but I'll tell you that the main reason that I am a Democrat has to do with the conduct of the Republican establishment in not seating African Americans at their convention. This goes way, way back. But that caught my attention. You know, how can you say that you are one nation under God when you say everybody except you? So then that, you know, that's about civil rights. And then the next thing is, I believe that every adult should have autonomy over his or her body. And so I am firmly in that camp. And that is the position most closely aligned with Democrats. I know not all Democrats believe that, but I am one who does. And I believe that the Democratic Party represents that. And then the third area, and this is where my dad and I, dad and I never talked about reproductive health care, I can tell you that. We did talk about civil rights, but the one thing that we talked the most about was the environment. And even as a Republican, my dad, when he left office, he was, as you said, the last one-term governor, he started a nonprofit called Environmental Quality Control. Bill Ruckelhaus had run on the ticket with him, and as you know, Bill Ruckelhaus from Indiana was the first EPA administrator. And the job of the Environmental Quality Control nonprofit was to, this is before the internet, this is before, you know, modems or anything, to mail out information about environmental regulations to corporations. Now, very quickly, in my mind, some of them use that material to get around the regulations. But the intent was to make sure that Indiana businesses were protecting our beautiful streams, our air quality, our soil quality. And so that in particular is an area that Dad and I shared. Now, I'm also saying that I don't think Dad would be in the Republican Party today. I don't think they'd want him because it was pretty egalitarian in his outlook on things. His own family background, his mother was a nurse and his father was a union auto worker. And so he always, and then his sister was a teacher. So when you look at that background, even though he was a successful attorney and a Republican, he comes from a background that is more sociologically aligned with the background of a Democrat.
Yeah, people, I think, lose track of how far right the Republican Party has gotten in the last, say, 40, 50 years, or that the EPA, which, you know, Republicans want to kill now, was started in the Nixon administration.
Right.
So I mean, you talked about your dad and your values a little bit. So, like, what, besides the environment stuff, what values did you keep from your Republican upbringing? And, you know, what did you discard?
Number one, strong public schools. as Dad used to say, I've got five kids. Of course, I support strong public schools. And 97% of the kids in Indiana attend public schools. And I believe that strengthening them, instead of going with some of the ideas that turn out to be failed experiments in education, look at the failure rate of these charter schools. Look at the forgiven loans from the Common School Fund loan to charter schools, hundreds and millions of dollars. Think of those dollars going to small schools down here. There's talk of school consolidation, that school corporations under 2,000 students would all come together and be in a mega school district. Here in Jackson County, that would mean our students from Brownstown, Crothersville, and Medora would all be forced into the Seymour School Corporation. I'm firmly opposed to that. And Dad believes in small schools too. So that would be one area that we would be the same. And of course, since his mother was a nurse, public health. You know, here in Southern Indiana, in Washington County, we don't even have a birthing hospital. So if you have a baby, you're going to have a baby and you live in Salem or any part in Washington County, you better make that plan. you know, and babies don't always cooperate with that. To get over here to Seymour or someplace to have your baby if you want to have your baby in a good, we have wonderful health care over here in Jackson County. We just need more of it in the district.
Yeah. So were there any rifts in the family over you leaving the party or, you brothers and sisters at each other's throats or any of that?
No, I just do remember one time when my dad was kind of unhappy with me for some other reason. And he said, oh, you make your life's work undermining the people I feel most proud of in American politics, and that Richard Lugar. And because I was working for a Democrat running against Richard Lugar, which wasn't like running against Richard Lugar. It was supporting a Democrat. But other than that, no, our family's a mixed bag politically. We still have some conservative members and we have some other members that are more closely aligned with my outlook.
And everybody manages to survive Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So you've had a long career in Indiana politics, mostly, I would say, behind the scenes. Yeah. President of the Indiana Federation of Democratic Women. You were a campaign manager for Glenda Ritz back in 2012. You've been executive director of the Indiana Retired Teachers Association. Talk a little bit about your time in those roles and things you found particularly challenging or rewarding. And then why is now the time for you to step out front and be a candidate yourself?
Even before, I worked in Senator Birchbeigh's reelection campaign in 80. And that was my first experience working with Indiana Democrats. Shortly after that, I joined a national voter contact firm, and we did congressional races all over the country. And it was at the time when we were just developing ways to target voters. And this was mostly through direct mail and phone calls and canvassing, many of the tools that we still use. But it was a time when we started using the voter file and layering it with demographic information we could purchase, like magazine subscriptions and PTA and all that kind of good stuff. So that allows candidates and parties to speak to voters on things that interest them. It's not that you say one thing to one group of voters and a completely opposite thing to another group of voters. It just allows us to more closely target our resources to the people who, number one, already support those ideas, and number two, who are maybe open to it. You know, I'll tell you, the persuasion universe, as we call it in the business, the swing voters, the people who are open to ideas, that's a vanishing group. The job now is finding voters. And we have a very good example of how that worked in Indiana in 2008 with the Obama campaign. And the Obama campaign, if they would have looked at the numbers, like I'm looking at the numbers in my district right now, they would have said, let's not spend a nickel on Indiana. And that's the way most presidential campaigns target their resources. Instead, the Obama campaign gave Hoosiers the tools they needed to reach out to a new, broaden the pool of voters. And that's what I'm going to do. I know that there are people in our district right now who are, I'll go ahead and say it out loud, embarrassed by the incumbent. His conduct of choosing to get behind the wheel after consuming lots of alcohol and smoking apparently lots of weed, and then leaving loaded guns in an abandoned vehicle. I mean, who does that? And then we saw him, you know, flash his gun at the state house. And it recently, he's been stirring anti-immigrant sentiment here in Southern, in Jackson County. We are positioning our community for a Ready 2.0 grant from the state of Indiana for much needed industrial development and housing and all the things that go with that, and the lift it's going to give to our local small businesses. My opponent, the incumbent, is going down the MAGA road with anti-immigration. He's printing T-shirts that say, shut it down. He's making available yard signs that say, shut it down. And it's really to the detriment. Do you know what it feels like to see people I grew up with aligning themselves with so much hate? It's heartbreaking. And so I think that there are people in this county and in Washington County, and I know in Scott County, who want things to be different. And I'm going to reach out and find them.
Very good. So, one of the top issues that you mentioned on your campaign website is something I talk about here all the time, and that's brain drain. You say you want to, quote, make it attractive so that when kids graduate high school, trade school, or college, they want to stay in our precious cities and towns, end quote. And that rural economic development is the way to do this. So can you talk a little bit about how the state and federal government can help? Sounds like there are some programs in place, and then how you plan to leverage those programs into tangible rural development, and is economic development enough alone to stop that brain drain?
That right there, let me answer the first part, and then I'll come to that, because that's part of it, Scott. The USDA rural development has placemaking programs. And those are programs that bring people together. And maybe we have some small restaurants, or we have an orchard, or we have a vineyard, or something that not only produces something that is available for consumers, but has a bit of cultural importance to it as well. And here in Seymour, we have a Chateau de Pigue, which is a vineyard and a place where you can do wine tasting, and they've added a brewery, and that's lifting up this community. There are other places down in Brownstown, the little part of, you go a little bit out of Brownstown, and there's a place called Ewing, Indiana. Same thing. There's an entrepreneurial couple. They came back to Jackson County from Ball State, and they have created a shared workspace. And that is because that's a county seat, and they recognize the need for a place for out-of-town attorneys to hang their hats, maybe even change their clothes because they are driving here or what have you. And then because of that, there's a little cafe that's picking up its speed. And these are the kinds of programs that are coming to life, and they need an advocate. And the incumbent is not advocating. Incumbent has a two-track mind, guns, and limiting abortions, and that's it. And so there's a whole big spectrum of responsibilities or active roles an elected official can play to lift up our communities in a positive way. And so that gets to the part about, is economic development enough? And is economic development enough? We have a phenomenon down here where executives of companies down here move to Columbus because of amenities. I understand that.
Thank you.
But why can't we have some of that here? You know, I think that there is a demand, if you want to turn it into a business idea. There are desires for our community. Look at the Jackson County Visitor Center and what they're doing down in Scott County and Washington County. They're creating environments where, I'll say, young people want to go and be part of a community. And I think as a state rep, that would be a very important part. I'm not going to be the mayor of all these towns, but I certainly am going to support what they do and be a spokesperson to advocate for these kinds of things that lift up the communities.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, that's one of the things I think about is like, you know, brain drain, people are leaving the rural areas. And if you ever, you know, you're driving through rural Indiana and you see all these abandoned houses and abandoned barns and abandoned buildings, and you think, boy, there are thousands and thousands of people just desperate to get into this country who would, you know, give an arm and a leg to live in these places and to build new lives and to bring culture and amenities, and the people that are already here don't want anything to do with that. And it's sad.
Well, I think part of the they don't want anything to do with it, there are a couple of things in my mind anyway. I may be incorrect, but I'm thinking about it this way. Number one, we're a low-wage state. There's no two ways about it. When a population has low income, lower than the national average, the disposable income isn't there to do these nice things. And when people have to work two jobs, let's say you've got a mom and a dad, and the dad works two jobs and the mom works a job, when do they have time to go to the PTA meeting or be part of the garden revitalization program or any of these things that contribute to a community's well-being? That's a tough thing. The other thing is, we are a desert for child care and elder care. I just went through this with my mother, and fortunately for our family, my sister Shelley was able to live with our mom. But even when she needed respite, she, you know, or we would come down when we could or go over to mom's or whatever. Still, the need for professional elder care, it is off the charts here. So when I talk about creating an environment to attract young people back to our area, I'm not talking about attracting them back and then they have no child care, or they have to, not have to, but they become responsible for elder care, which actually requires professional training in some cases for dementia victims. So that's what I'm talking about. Let's all pull together. And then it gets back to, how do we conduct ourselves in a civic dialogue? Are we talking about welcoming? Are we talking about lifting up? Are we talking about being good neighbors? Or are we doing that other stuff?
Yeah, especially with the youth who are, you know, increasingly queer and value bodily autonomy and just openness and acceptance. And I guess no matter how good the economy is, if you don't feel welcome in a place, it's really tempting to just get out.
Right. I've been working very closely with some young people to hear them and to start thinking, this is what they're telling us. You know, I'm old. I'm just like, you know, somebody else we know says I'm old, I'll admit it. And when I was younger, we were all out there, you know, fist waving and marching and holding our signs and all that. the folks here, the young people who are my age when I was doing that, are like, we're not doing that. We don't want the social consequences of being known as someone who supports these kinds of ideas, because there's repercussions in the workplace for expressing these ideas and all kinds of stuff that you wouldn't imagine, Scott. But there is a genuine fear out there for people in that age group of becoming activists and expressing themselves. And that's another thing I would like to see change.
Well, that's the it's certainly easier to just leave, right, than to fight. And I don't blame the people that do. I understand why they do, you know, and I wish Indiana was just a more welcoming environment. It would benefit the state on every level. So in addition to rural economic development, one of the big issues you talk about in your campaign is substance abuse, particularly the rural opioid crisis. And you're passionate about curbing substance abuse in our communities and have an intensely personal connection to the issue. And if you're comfortable talking about that, will you?
Sure, I will. I will. I will, because it is desperation, and it is loneliness, and it is all the things that are unimaginable to people who are not in that life. And in some, it's a disease, but it's also treatable. And I remember before I my son died at age 26 after going through rehabilitation, and not the first time, not the second time, but the third time. And you know, how lucky were we that we could send him to these places for treatment. And it is a situation, and I'm not blaming any parent who just gets to the end of their rope. I understand that can happen. So before, when my son was still a little kid, that's when the outbreak in Scott County occurred with the, you know, people mainlining Opana. And I went to the commissioner's meeting, and I learned so much then about intravenous drug use and the grips of addiction and harm prevention, how beneficial harm prevention can be in an individual life and in public health, in the statistical world of public health. And then I went on this journey with my son, and also I thought about my grandmother, the nurse. Her best friend was Mary Beatty, and Richard Beatty was my classmate, and Richard Beatty's son had a similar journey to my son's. And now Ben is heading a recovery community organization here. And so I have, you know, pledged to help them in any way I can and to lend a public voice, you know, whatever I can do to help this community recovery organization, recovery community organization, get off the ground and help people, because it's one thing to go through the rehab, but the sober living experience is harm prevention is something that people don't understand very well. The sober living community is also something people don't understand very well. Because when you quit alcohol abuse or drug abuse, you have to say goodbye to your friends.
Yeah.
And even if they're doing things that are harmful to themselves or to you, they're still your friends. They're still your human connections. And so lifting up the sober community, sober living community, and helping bring more resources for mental health. You can't get an appointment with a therapist down here. Even if you have the money and time, there isn't anything. And we have got to get smart about doing what needs to be done to bring these resources to rural communities. You think the whole thing about rural communities, Scott, and that is, are we just going to let the market functions like drain all these small communities? And are we just going to have acres and miles of farms and maybe a few gas stations and maybe a couple of post offices just to get the mail out, or maybe we'll all go to FedEx? No. You know, when I was at the Retired Teachers Association, I would speak with the legislators. I would say, in many of our communities, the school corporation is the economic engine. So when you have an economic engine that is paying substandard wages, and you have retirees who stay in the community and their retirement benefits are not keeping up with inflation, don't put any economic development money in there because nobody has any money to spend. You know, that is a big factor. And teachers deserve more pay because of the kind of work they need to do. It's harder to work with these students. And it's not just teachers' pay. It's resources for educators to do the job they need to do.
Yeah. And I wanted to sort of get at this, and you sort of walked into it, talking about the mental health aspect of addiction and the lack of mental health services in rural areas. And so, like, how does your work with on the substance abuse issue tie in to the the public health realm and mental health, especially like rural mental health?
Well, that would, of course, be bringing more resources. But I also would like to highlight something that's happening in Scott County, where the sheriff there, Jerry Gooden, has a program that engages people as soon as they come in to custody. And the basic speech to these folks is this: you have been convicted of a crime. You are in our custody. You have a choice now to engage with the things we can offer you. Or if you choose not to, then you'll just be serving your time and you'll get out and you won't have the benefit of the things. And that includes mental health treatment. That includes substance treatment. That includes agreements with apprenticeships in the building trades, and work with Ivy Tech to get some kind of education thing going for these folks. Now, he's been doing this for about 18 months, and of the 28 people who have gone through this program, only one has committed a crime. Now, that is outstanding. So that is a combination of law enforcement, mental health, public health, and education coming together under the sheriff's leadership to offer the support, and they have supports for families of these people who are incarcerated. And so it's a holistic approach. And so maybe we should get that idea going someplace else in this county. We had a chance, I don't know if you know the IRAC program that they're doing with law enforcement. This is a state program. Jackson County was eligible for it, and for some reason we did not get it. So that is something that I'm looking for, a synergy of resources, a little bit from here, a little bit from here. Let's put them together so that we will be able to offer the counseling and public health that this area deserves and needs.
Yeah, it sounds like you got a sheriff down there who's, willing to think outside the box and experiment a little bit. Because unfortunately, the criminal justice system is the primary entryway into the mental health system in far too many places. And excuse me, at least it sounds like they're making an effort to get people into those mental health services. In far too many places, it's just incarceration and that's it. I want to ask about, with your strong feelings on substance abuse situation and that Indiana is surrounded by states that have some degree of legal marijuana, and we're the only state in our neighborhood that doesn't. I'm interested to hear like how your I guess a history with, substance abuse, being close to that, affects your feelings about potentially legalizing cannabis in Indiana?
I know that it's a very popular idea to legalize marijuana. I also understand that there's growing evidence of the problems with Adderall, some of these attention deficit drugs that like every kid in junior high is taking, apparently, and marijuana, that there is a growing body of evidence about how that can develop into a psychosis. And I know this from some research I've done with a physician and some people close to me who have experienced this. So that's one thing that makes me kind of, maybe medical marijuana, because I do believe the research on post-traumatic stress disorders. My heart goes out to people who whose remedy for that or chronic pain is marijuana, and they live in a state where it's illegal. I have a very good friend who lives in a state where marijuana is legal. Her husband has traumatic injury from service, and when they came here, it was like they can't stay too long because otherwise he has to go back on pills, and you don't want to do that. And I understand that. And so I think, and newsflash, it's illegal federally, still controlled substance. So there's that. And I understand the benefits of the tax money. I understand that. I understand that there are applications where smoking marijuana is therapeutic and supported with medical evidence. And I also understand the disproportionate arrests for possession of marijuana among people of color, our Hispanics, African Americans, people of color. I understand that, and that's a law enforcement problem right there. And so, all in all, the other thing is, what do the people of this district want me to do about it? I am going to tell them what I think about it, and I'm welcome to hear what they have to say about it. But I'm not just jumping on the everybody, get high and smoke weed train. Not going to do it.
Fair enough. We've talked a little bit about mental health, and it seems like there is one mental health condition specific to downtown Indianapolis alone, and you call it limestone fever. Will you describe this phenomena for the listeners?
Yes, I will. And as I've said, it isn't what people get when they work in a quarry. It is what happens to otherwise pretty smart people when they enter the State House, which is made of our beautiful Indiana limestone. I got this term in my mind when I worked in the State House, when I worked at the Department of Education, because I could see legislators who forgot who sent them there, forgot they were elected by the people of their district, and they started thinking other legislators, lobbyists, and big money donors were their constituents. And so, you know, not this previous session. I'm waiting for Common Cause to release the facts on this session. But in the previous session, lobbyists gave over $20 million in gifts to legislators. Pacer tickets, Colts tickets, expensive dinners, trips, all that kind of stuff. And there's a handful of Republicans and Democrats who take nothing, not even a cup of coffee from a lobbyist. And I, when elected, I'll be in that group too. So there's no need. If I want to go see the Pacers, I'll get my own damn tickets, you know. And I think that the business of the public needs to be conducted in public.
Yeah.
And so maybe that sounds nice. And I've been in plenty of back rooms that I know, not like I don't know anything about them. But if there is valuable information that needs to be shared, it can be shared with transparency. Mm-hmm.
So, you talked about the incumbent, Mr. Lucas, a little bit. From here, it looks like that guy's got way more than just limestone fever afflicting him. So, I mean, you mentioned a little bit of this guy's background. Like, what's up with this dude? He drunk driving while, you know, while under the influence of THC, leaving the scene of an accident, you know, leaving his guns, flashing his guns at students in the state house. And yet, he won over 70% of the vote in that district in the last election.
Right.
So, why is Trish Whitcomb the candidate to overcome such long odds against this guy?
Well, I'll tell you what. Part of it's personal. And it goes to how much he uses his persona as a Marine. You know, he served our country as a Marine and all that goes with that. And I have been disgusted. And I wrote a letter to the editor. It was published in the Indianapolis Star as well as a local paper down here when he chose to get behind the wheel intoxicated and to, you know, just be so irresponsible with his guns. And I'm like, if you're a Marine, have you read the Creed lately? You know, do you know about honoring? You know, do you know these things that you took a vow to support? I don't think that your conduct is really reflective of that. And he also said one time in a public meeting that he considered himself my dad's legacy. I don't think my dad would author a bill that allowed kids to take guns to school. I'm just saying. So, and we have needs down here. And I have background and I know people and I know how to get things done. And we need to get some stuff done down here. And he's not doing it. And so that's why I'm running.
So, give us that big closing pitch then, Trish. Like, you know, you have the relationships and the network and know how to leverage and get stuff done around there. Your opponent is not committed to doing anything, it seems like, because, you know, doing anything is communism, right? Tell us, you know, why Trish Whitcomb is the right person for House District 69. And then where can people find out more about your campaign?
Well, you can find out more about my campaign at www.whitcomb4indiana.com. That's my website. And I have a Facebook page. It has the same name, Whitcomb for Indiana, on Facebook. You've pretty well enumerated everything. And this is one thing about stepping out from behind to be out in front. It's kind of different for me, you know, and so, and also being brought up to be very modest and supportive. And I think being modest and supportive is our great characteristics for an elected official, but I got to get elected. And so I'm inviting anyone who's listening to do what they can to help me get elected. And that means you could come over here and you could go door to door, or you could make phone calls from anywhere. We have this wonderful thing called cell phones now, and there's no long distance charges. And of course, donating money. I have an Act Blue page, Whitcomb for Indiana, Act Blue, or my post office box is Post Office Box 852, Seymour, Indiana, 47274. I'm going to have a very vigorous campaign. Tonight I'm having like 20 volunteers here, and we will be making phone calls. We will be setting up precinct level organizations. In some of the bigger precincts, we'll have four or five people who are precinct captains. That's a grassroots approach. It's not a free money approach because you still have to do things, but I'm going to give it my best, and we'll just see how it turns out.
Well, very good. Trish Whitcomb, thank you for joining the Who's Left podcast. It has been a pleasure.
Same to you, and thank you so much for talking with me today, Scott.
Once again, that was Democratic candidate for House District 69, Trish Whitcomb. In an informal internet poll, I asked a random sample of Hoosiers what they want in a representative from District 69, and to a T, they said, 69? Nice. Seriously. Incumbent Representative Jim Lucas is not nice. In fact, he's a mean-spirited bully. The kind of guy who intimidates minors with a firearm in the state capitol, posts racist memes on Facebook, mocks assault victims, and peddles dangerous conspiracy theories. This is a man who seems to think every problem in the world could be solved by more guns. Well, he's not always mean. He was awfully chummy with the arresting officers in May 2023 after Lucas, who had been driving his pickup southbound on State Road 11, quote, went off the road, down a large hill, and hit the guardrail, which pushed it into the right lane of I-65 North. After that, Lucas allegedly continued driving across all three lanes of I-65 North, striking the median guardrail. After doing a U-turn and going the wrong way on the entrance ramp, Lucas continued to drive for nearly 3 miles. End quote. On his rims, three missing tires, before parking his truck behind a local business, getting out, walking, and leaving a loaded firearm in his abandoned vehicle. Jim Lucas is an embarrassment and needs to go. But how did we get from the Republican Party of Ed Whitcomb, who supported public schools, public health, and a clean environment, to this MAGA clown show of Jim Lucas, Jim Banks, Todd Rokita, and Donald Trump? I think Trish saw the seeds of this toxicity beginning to sprout in her father's GOP and got out early. But as it spread, it consumed much of the small town and rural life conservatives claimed to champion. The Republicans have been the party of big business since the 1870s, and solidly so since the 1920s. They vehemently fought FDR's New Deal and LBJ's Great Society, the platforms that built a prosperous middle class in this country. They favored an unregulated free market and labeled as communism any government effort to improve people's lives. But there were plenty of socially liberal Republicans like Dewey, Eisenhower, and Rockefeller. At the same time, the Democratic coalition was an uneasy alliance between urban voters and conservative Southern and rural voters. Despite their geographical and cultural differences, both groups believed in economic progressivism and social welfare policies. That is, government should intervene in economic matters to improve quality of life outcomes. The party increasingly embraced the civil rights movement, and this drove a wedge into that coalition, breaking it irreparably. Lyndon Johnson reportedly said, quote, "I think we just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come," end quote. Not only did equality for Black Americans deliver Georgia and Alabama to the GOP, but the Mississippi of the North as well, our Indiana. This fault line had shown itself, with a presidential run by Dixiecrat Strom Thurmond in 1948 and an independent run by segregationist George Wallace in 1968. Seeing weakness, the Goldwater campaign invented and the Nixon campaign perfected the Southern strategy, welcoming disaffected social conservatives into the Republican Party with open arms. By 1980, the transformation was complete. What the media touted as Reagan Democrats were Dixiecrats under the Scooby-Doo mask. And some, I assume, were good people. So this is what was happening when Trish came of age politically. As the angry white vote moved into the Republican Party, they drove people like her away. And what has happened since? Well, the GOP never stopped being the party of big business. They may have welcomed rural and conservative voters with open arms, but they never loved you. They only love you for your huge voter turnout. Their main squeeze has always been market supremacy and government austerity. As I talked to Trish, I noticed a recurring theme: small town and rural abandonment. It's been 50 years of slow decay as we've turned the keys to our communities completely over to market forces. Well, what happens then? Walmart comes in, all the mom and pops close up, farmers are bent over by a barrel by big seed companies, big pesticide companies, big equipment manufacturers, and big food processing cartels. We send people to Indianapolis and Washington that say they're fighting for the little guy, but when they get there, limestone fever sets in. They defund schools so their profiteering donors can come in and open private charters. They let healthcare monopolies consolidate and close rural hospitals and clinics, and they allow pharmaceutical giants to dump vast quantities of opioids on the market with impunity. So, no jobs, no schools, no hospitals. All that's left is the drugs. The market, left to its own devices, will not take care of low population areas. It's not efficient. It's not profitable. There is a low return on investment. The market will suck every tiny bit of profit out of our small communities and abandon them as soon as the money well dries up. Government is necessary to fill these gaps. Public schools, public hospitals, public clinics, not only do these things fulfill vital community needs, but they also provide jobs. They could be good, well-paying union jobs if we quit outsourcing essential services to thirsty middlemen. And complementary businesses pop up alongside these community anchors. Government investment is good for the private sector too. Market fundamentalist Republicans have played us. Our fear and anxiety over the new and different has been weaponized against us. The vast majority of us used to agree that government should be used to help people. But we've been conditioned to believe that government is the problem. In reality, unregulated capitalism was the enemy this whole time. But Democrats, the only ones advocating for government to, you know, do stuff, abandon these areas when the votes dried up, and abandon their economic populist ideals. I think Democrats have an in with small town and rural voters if we choose to pursue it. But we've got to get back to our economic populist roots, and we've got to show up. Government investment is in. Welcoming new diverse people to our small towns is in. Doing big things together is back in. But first, we've got to kick the limestone fever-addled stooges like Jim Lucas out. Thanks for listening. Follow me on Facebook, Blue Sky, YouTube, and TikTok at Who's Left, and on most other social media sites at ScottRodge78. If you want to reach me, send me a DM on the socials or email me at ScottRodge78@gmail.com. My guest today, Trish Whitcomb, you can find at Whitcomb4Indiana.com. That's with the number 4. If you haven't yet, when you're finished here, go to ScottAaronRodgers.substack.com and subscribe at the paid level. Help me keep this project going. Until next time, this has been the Who's Left Podcast. I'm Scott Aaron Rodgers. Love each other, Indiana.